Come in. William Castle, the producer of this motion picture, has a question for you.
Do you believe in ghosts? Some people believe in them. Others do not. Personally, I do. And I feel sure that when you leave this theater, you too will believe in ghosts. No more dictation today. When you came in, you were given a special ghost viewer like this. And here's how it works. Would you please change the color of the screen? Thank you. You must only use it when the screen changes to this kind of a bluish color. Then you raise the viewer to your eyes and you look at the screen through it. If you believe in ghosts, you look through the red part of the viewer. If you do not believe in ghosts, you look through the blue part. Would you please change the color again? Thank you. Now, when the screen resumes its normal color, like this, remove the viewer from in front of your eyes until the next time the screen becomes blue. Oh, one more thing. If someone sits down next to you during the picture, it would be helpful if you would show him or her how the viewer should be used. And remember, if you believe in ghosts, look through the red part. If you don't believe in ghosts, look through the blue. Happy haunting. Goodbye for now. Shall we go?
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and waiting in the wings is Jeff Omega.
Like, hey guys, how's it going?
That was a terrible Shaggy.
It was a terrible Shaggy.
And are you Thelma? Trish Cocklin, everybody.
I think I'm Velma. I think, well, I don't know. I don't think there's anything such as ghosts. So we have to find the guy who runs the amusement park.
We're going to be talking about the 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo. Oh, no. I forgot. Yeah, we're just going to do the other ones instead. As much as everybody wants us to talk about 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, we're going to be just talking about the 13 Ghosts. The original one was from 1960, from Carney Huckster, William Castle, the B-grade Alfred Hitchcock, maybe? and of course, the 2001 remake by Steve Beck. You know, I've had the original one in my library for quite some time, but I don't think I'd ever watched it before, and I must have misplaced my viewer, because my DVD has both versions of it, so you can just watch in a standard black and white, or the one designed for the viewer. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Oh, wow.
The original 1960 film, and we use the intro directly from William Castle on this episode, so our fan base should already be up to speed. It came with this viewer, and it was essentially with the red screen and the blue screen, much like a 3D film. But it would be this strip, so eyes could look through one or the other. And when the film went blue, if you wanted to see the ghosts, you looked through the red. And if you didn't want to see the ghosts, you looked through the blue if you were at the coward window. Movie's not particularly scary. And I doubt that even worked very well, because you could still see them if you didn't put on the glasses. So
that was the thing, though. I heard a lot of people say that it did, like, in the theater, with the way it was projected and everything, it did work surprisingly well.
Yeah, I wish...
But at the same time, nobody used it, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know if I got screwed out of the viewer on when I bought this thing, or if I just stuck it in an envelope and misplaced it somewhere, but... I can't find it, and I wish I did. I should have just grabbed a 3D glasses somewhere. I know I've got some of those kicking around, and then just close one eye or the other, yeah. Just to see if it would work. But yeah, the disc was really cool, because you could just watch it in black and white on one side, or flip it over and watch it in its original format with the Technicolor, where it goes blue or red. Cool. Or blue or black and white, okay. So you can use the viewer as well. So it was a cool experience, and it's kind of fun to think about movies in that way. I kind of wish I'd been around and alive in the 60s when William Castle was touring these things. Like, what cool keepsakes those were, and to involve an audience into a film.
On my DVD, there was a little featurette that was about the viewer specifically. And it was just, the whole thing was about how, yeah, like, everybody watched the movie and they liked it, but the main thing was is that they got to watch a movie that had memorable moments, but they got to take away something from it, and everybody held on to it.
Yeah.
And there was something about how a pretty large portion of people who have them had them when they saw them in the theater. I don't know if that's true now, because people die and get older, but at least the time of people interviewed who they could find who had them. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's a cool thing that William Castle tried to do to try to make going to a theater special, where you could go away with something.
Yeah, and this was his innate fear as a filmmaker and a producer. He was afraid, like, okay, just because I made the movie doesn't mean they'll go. So he's really out there trying to sell the movie and give them a reason to go. So if they maybe have this gimmick... And he did that with a large portion of his movies. I talked about this back when we did House on Haunted Hill as well. And everybody knows how much I love to talk about William Castle, because he's such a fascinating man. This particular gimmick was called Illusion-O.
Illusion-O.
And most of his gimmicks were something-O. Because it wasn't a gimmick until it was Illusion-O. Or I got a few other ones written down here. He did an insurance policy for Lloyd's of London when he did Macabre. There was a Merjo. That was the House on Haunted Hill. And if anybody remembers, you can go back to listen to the episode. But basically, if you went to the theater, they'd had like a skeleton hiding behind the curtain. And when the skeleton came out during the movie, it would come out in the theater as well, which would be, you know, everybody'd be into the gag the first time, but after they've seen it once and they go back, then everybody and their dog is trying to knock that sucker down.
Yeah.
And throwing crap at it. So sounds like fun to me, though. Yeah, I mean, you think about the ballyhoo of this guy. There was Percepto with the Tingler. And do you guys remember what that gimmick was?
Yeah, was absolutely.
That was the electrified seats.
Yeah,
that's the one where
basically the joy buzzer.
The theater would go black. And Vincent Price would say something like, oh, the Tingler has gone loose in the theater. And then random seats in the audience would buzz.
Yeah.
See, stuff like that, I think that would be like, it's weird. It's sort of a two-sided coin, where it'd be, I would love to go and have the experience, but I know so many hooligans where this would just like jack them up and they would be just hard to control in an audience. But it sounds like a lot of fun.
There was a Homicidal, which was his kind of answer to Alfred Hitchcock, who kind of stole some of the huckster stuff from William Castle. And he did another movie called Homicidal. And now Homicidal had what they called the Fright Break. And then when he first instituted it, he's like, okay, nobody's going to get up and get their money back during the Fright Break. And the first showing, the entire audience gets up. And leaves and gets their money back. But they all returned for the next showing, because they'd had their money back to go through this again. So he was on to them, and he's like, okay, now we got to issue colored tickets. But to make sure they were shamed, he instituted the Coward's Corner. So if you left during the Fright Break, you had to sit in the Coward's Corner until everybody else came out to get your refund. And so everybody would see you shamed in the coward's corner. That's the kind of stuff that William Castle did. And what an awesome way to kind of promote a film and keep an audience engaged. And in the time that we're in now, how do you convince audiences to come back out? 3D certainly isn't going to be the answer. I don't think even the lure of another Marvel movie will be entirely enough. So how do you do that? Maybe reviving some of these romantic notions or these more panicked notions of William Castle of really traveling and selling and making a show out of it. You still hear about it from time to time. I know Adam Green would do that with his last couple of Hatchet movies, would tour it around and make it quite an experience. Oh, those horror musicals me and Sam watched at 31 Days of Horror, and I'm blanking on it. Darren Lynn Bousman directed those, and he toured those around as well. And they'd have, like...
Repo?
No, it wasn't Repo. It was after Repo.
Was it the Devil's Carnival?
Devil's Carnival. And those toured around, and they'd have carnival acts in the theater as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
See, and that's, like, kind of cool stuff. Like, that's also, they had musicals, too, where people would sing along. So, like, it's a whole thing. When you involve the audience, they do want to go out because they're like, this is a one-of-a-kind experience. You're not going to get it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Maybe that's the answer. Maybe not, but... cool notion nonetheless.
Remember the old days when we'd go out for commemorative cups? That was fun. I remember when Star Wars came out, I was like, you gotta get all the Star Wars cups.
Yeah, I do recall doing that. Might even still have some of them. I don't know. Or they'd be sitting at my parents' house if we do, but I totally remember all that stuff.
They were perfect for milkshakes, FYI.
When I suggested this, Jeff had just watched this original film. Mm-hmm. Had you ever seen it before, Trish?
No, I hadn't. I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah, this was one of those, I may have ducked it into my DVD player real quick, and then I was bored and didn't want to watch it, or just wasn't in the right frame of mind. But man, so this really was the first time I sat down and watched it. What a lot of fun. Like, it's... Yeah. It's dumb fun. It's not scary. I mean, William Castle movies are, for the most part, his audience were kids, really. And this kind of watches like kid scares. And sometimes it's so badly made, like that fly on the, you could see the wire. I think it was the only time I actually spotted the wire, but
true.
That fly scene was terrible.
But the part that made me scared was the whole bit with like Ben. And I'm like, why is he here? Why is he hanging around this family? Like, I felt the family was in peril from a real threat the whole time.
Initially, his character...
That's what's scared.
Initially, his character was like, oh, okay, he's falling for the daughter. But once he learns there's actual money in the house, then the green-eyed monster comes out.
Oh, see, he didn't hide it well, because I was sitting there going, like, why is this guy still fucking around? Like, I mean, I kept going, like, there's something wrong with
He's
that guy.
He's a lawyer. Yeah. No, it's interesting how they used him. Jeff, what were you about to say there?
Oh, I was just going to say that, to tie in what we were saying earlier with, it being targeted to kids and how the whole movie is just super fun. And one of my favorite parts of the movie is that the whole movie is very, very reminiscent of, an old-timey haunted house, but one of those really good haunted houses where it's not necessarily scary, but everything is really clever and it's really fun, and overall it's spooky.
Mm.
And, I think that more haunted houses could be more like 13 Ghosts, the original one.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
To have a 60s charm. They did try to make the ghosts unique in their own ways.
And they were cool. Like the one that was chopping off the head, or like the one that was chopping the hatchet into the other person's head.
The weird axe man.
Yeah.
You have the angry chef.
Yes.
There was the swirling, those three ghosts in the basement that would light on fire and then coalesce into this swirling thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think
one of them
swirling,
was just a skeleton.
That swirling effect one, that swirling ghost, I think they used in a Star Trek episode, like from the original series.
Probably.
Star Trek reused a lot of stuff.
The whole three things just screaming. And wasn't one of the ghosts like just a head? That was burning.
It might have been, yeah. And I remember there's one we first saw, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. Why is he not, like, transparent like the other ones, the superimposed effect that they did in the 60s? Why can't we see through this one? It's, like, more of a monster. I'm like, huh. Which does wind up coming to play a little bit later.
Yep.
As the mystery unfolds. Now, with the characters, this family has inherited this house, the Zorba family, and the patriarch of the family, the father, not very good with his money, works in a museum as a tour guide and historian. At the opening of the film, all the furniture is being taken away. Very comedic, very 60s kind of moment. Yeah. I really kind of liked it. It felt like a 60s sitcom kind of moment, honestly, but I liked how fun it felt, and this wish from their son suddenly comes true. Mm-hmm. And as the lawyer comes and says, hey, you've inherited this house, your uncle, who was some sort of doctor scientist guy, had passed away, and Dr. Plato Zorba left the estate to his nephew. And he just happened to collect ghosts. And if you can see the ghost, you can apparently collect the ghost. That's what the glasses come in.
But can we also get to the point where, like, the wish comes true and there's the creepiest telegram guy?
Oh, yeah.
He comes in and he opens the door to, like, complete darkness. And you're, like, going, no, that's not outside. What's happening there?
There's a whole story about that short delivery guy. That's, yes. He's super creepy.
Absolutely. Oh, my God, that guy's so great. I want more of him in this movie.
We're a few minutes in here. Let's visit the first trailer for the 1960 version of the film, introduced by William Castle himself and some clips from the movie. And it's really cool in that 60s vein. And there's a little long music bit at the end because it's still falling off from the 50s where they like to emblazon words on the screen that I'm not going to read to you.
Listen to William Castle, whom the Saturday Evening Post calls the master of movie horror.
Do you believe in ghosts? I do. And you will too, when you come to this theater and see my picture, 13 Ghosts. No more dictation today. When you see 13 Ghosts, you'll be given a supernatural viewer like this, which will enable you to penetrate for the first time into the spirit world. It will let you see all 13 of our weird, wonderful, and wildly assorted ghosts.
Now, brace yourself as we take you across the threshold of our haunted mansion, where there's a ghost for everyone in the family. Father, mother, sister, brother. You'll be scared stiff, too, when you see what they see. 13 ghosts materializing in ectoplasmic color through the magic of Illusiono, the ghost viewer. The ghost of a lion in the basement. The ghost of a murderous cook in the kitchen.
Stop it! Stop it, I say!
The ghost who speaks through the lips of the living.
Death tonight. To one of you.
The evil ghost in the bedroom, fighting to take possession of this beautiful girl. You'll feel all the thrills and chills of seeing one ghost multiplied by the magic number 13.
Okay, and we're back. So that was the trailer for 13 Ghosts from 1960, written by Rob White, who also wrote The House on Haunted Hill for William Castle, which we covered back in episode 134. And of course, William Castle, as I mentioned, directed Macabre, The Old Dark House, as well as producing, this is probably his biggest movie, Rosemary's Baby. He really wanted to direct it, but an up-and-comer named Roman Polanski, kind of the studio was a little more high on this guy, and it worked out.
It did. Oh, but FYI, if you want to really, The Old Dark House is a lot of fun, so watch that as well. That's my recommendation.
Excellent.
Was he also involved in The Old Dark House from a couple years ago?
No. The Old Dark House, it's a 1930s one. It's, I can't even really describe it.
It's probably that's like directed 40s. That's directed by the guy who directed Frankenstein, James Whale.
No.
It's brilliant. It's no, so old, weird.
Old Dark House silly. Is William Castle. That's why I attached it to William Castle. William Castle did a lot of stuff, a lot of studio stuff before he ventured off into doing his own thing. And he had such great success that Columbia, who he was basically director for hire at that point, invited him back to do what he wanted, essentially. So for most of his career, he was at Columbia. Who do you think the star of this movie is, by the way?
It's
certainly not the one who got top billing.
No, definitely not. Well, I mean,
I'd say the father,
is.
Right? The father.
Yeah, that's the right answer. That's the correct answer is.
Well, yeah, because the father gets fifth billing.
Whoa!
So, in order of star, so the number one bill is the kid, Charles Herbert, who plays Buck Zorba. The little kid gets and he featured fairly prominently, but I wouldn't call him the star of this movie. And
you know what? He doesn't even have that much charisma for a kid actor.
No. You know, he was in The Fly as well. We probably mentioned him back in episode 101 when we talked about The Fly.
Mm-hmm.
Good for him, I guess.
Joe Morrow played Medea Zorba, his sister, and she was in a bunch of stuff. Our Man in Havana, to name one. Martin Milner was Benjamin Rush, the really cool named lawyer. he was in Valley of the Dolls, but most famous for being on television on Route 66 and Adam 12. He was the star of both of those shows for our 60s audience. Hilda Zorba, the mom of the family, was Rosemary DeCamp, and she was in a fun satire horror movie called Saturday the 14th.
Nice.
I still haven't watched that. I've always wanted to watch that.
I think I have it on VHS.
Not great.
But... I've wanted to watch that since I was a kid, and I never have. Donald Woods, who I think is the star of this movie, the father who works in the museum and is the nephew that inherits all this, and gets fifth billing and was in movies like True Grit. Donald Woods, who plays Cyrus Zorba. Now, his namesake, Cyrus, who would go on to be the uncle character who leaves the fortune and house to the family in the remake that used Cyrus as the name of the uncle. Margaret Hamilton would be really recognizable. She played Elaine Zacharides. She was in Ghostbreakers, but she's certainly most famous for being the Wicked Witch in Wizard of Oz. And there's a wink and a nod in the movie right at the end. I mean, we see her with the broom more than once. They call her a witch a lot. And within the film, they ask, are you a witch? Are you a witch? And she does the kind of wink at the end of the movie, which probably didn't play near as well as it does now. Because in 1960, Wizard of Oz might have just been starting to do its seasonal tour on television. But now we all get it. We all know who that person is.
Well, I know that for her specifically, that was the first movie and real work that she'd been able to get for quite a lot of years, like maybe even more than a decade of anything really significant because of how typecast she was from Wizard of Oz.
And at least she leaned into it and they got a nice gag out of that. And finally, John Van Drielen was Van Allen. And that was Cyrus's boss at the museum who did a lot of research for them. And I just want to mention it because what a cool movie this sounds like. He was in another kind of 60s horror movie called The Leech Woman.
Nice.
We've all met one at one at a time.
Hey,
I've met more than my fair share of leech men.
Yeah.
That's the sequel.
Everybody's met a leech.
I'm hoping the leech woman isn't near as metaphorical as we're assuming it is.
No. Honestly, considering how much, like, we've all been babies, quite frankly, we were parasites to our own mothers, technically.
Well, don't feed me out of the tits.
Exactly. That's the whole point. But no, but like, you took all your nutrients from your mother. Like, parasites live in another animal and take nutrients off of them. That's what babies are.
Wow.
Yeah.
You but do parasites not like kids.
They're invasive, not. Though. You know, I mean, not saying that children are inherently invasive, but like, a parasite attacks to get into you. Not saying anything.
Yeah, but they certainly take. It's a very invasive way to do pregnancy. And honestly, you know what? Here's the thing. Babies are the leading cause of adult assholes. They were all once babies.
It's true. 100% of the world's assholes are produced by women who give birth to babies, because all babies have them.
Well,
yep.
If they just did it in the asshole, we wouldn't have this problem.
But the whole point is, they grow up to be assholes. It doesn't matter.
No, I read one.
Oh,
one.
You they missed
do the, it to
you,
your asshole when they grow up.
You missed
okay,
the joke.
Okay, we've lost track.
Okay, go ahead.
It's gone off the rails. Okay, well, that was the cast and some really gross talk of 13 Ghosts 1960. And yes, basically the family inherits the house, and nobody's really believing in the stories until Buck stumbles across this little hidden thing above the fireplace, and it's hiding this Ouija board and a book in it. So they tried the Ouija board, and we've seen a million films where that always goes fine.
Oh, you know what? I loved how when they brought out the Ouija board, it was 100% just a commercial for Ouija boards.
Yeah.
Like, they brought it out, and they were showing it off to the camera. But it was some of the finest product placement I have seen in a film.
Yeah.
It was the only organic product placement I've really seen in a film.
And interesting when you could just casually market something that was inherently supernatural without people being afraid of it. And I think that there was a very short window of time where you could get away with casual, you know, occultism before it became too scary.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, definitely an interesting hallmark of that time.
Yeah. Does anybody think that the Buck would have grown up to be like some sort of serial killer or something?
In both versions.
Or black wizard.
Yeah.
Like, he's asking the board, is anybody going to die? The seance happens. Is anybody going to die? No, nobody's going to die. Oh.
Yeah.
I want somebody right. murdered. Like, what is wrong with this kid?
So ridiculous.
The monsters, the banality of evil, the little monsters growing up all around us.
Yeah, when he gets
again,
the
children.
Oh, good lord. you have some therapy bills to pay for.
I really do.
When the kid gets those glasses and all these ghosts are showing up in the basement and then lighting on fire. Well, that, I think that was his dad. But when you see the ghost, lion. The lion, that was it. The lion, and his encounter was the lion and lion tamer who got his head bit off.
Yeah.
And you know what? None of it's really freaking him out. He's actually thinks it's pretty cool.
It's a little too long. Like, that scene goes on for a bit. I was always expecting him to go back and grab the whip and at least try against the lion.
You know, the best part about that whole thing is, you know what happened is they're just baiting the lion to bite the stump of the head as if he was putting his head inside the lion's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a while for him to convince the lion to bite his head. But instead of doing a regular thing, like playing the part of the clip, you know, with the end that they wanted and making it shorter, they just showed the entire clip to fill time because they had a lion. You could see
that poor actor. Lion. That lion took swipes at where his head was.
Right? Wow, hey?
Rough.
Like, goddamn. It's a good thing he had, like, a big prosthetic over there his head.
Yeah.
I was more scared for the scene.
Right?
Yeah, lions are scary in movies. There's a lot of stories of lions gone awry, not entirely because lions are bad, just because people can't handle wild animals on a close set very well.
Well, and lions don't quite understand what's going on. It's just a lion. It's being a lion.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's something I wanted to bring up, too. The beauty about William Castle films as a whole is, and why people like to revisit them and remake them, is because they're one location movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, totally. Minimal cast, one location sets. They might be elaborate sets. I mean, the Williams weren't that elaborate at the time. They're fairly bare bones. Even the house, it's like, oh, you could use a little more decorating. But I guess you probably did some cleaning up after the doctor died.
Now, would you say that on some level William Castle is like DC Comics and Roger Corman is like Marvel Comics, in that William Castle and Roger Corman both were very independent people who unorthodoxly went about their own ways to have their own little film empires, but one's a lot more commercial and the other one's a lot more hip, you know?
I know you're trying to play to my profession at Words and Pictures. Visit us at wnp.ca.
Well, you know, and also,
I would not, because you got one owned by Disney and one owned by Warner. Not at all.
Oh, but, you know, like, I'm thinking, like, the spirit of the time as well.
I wonder if you would also kind of consider the difference between the two of them. Like, Roger Corman did make a lot of films, but like when you look at William Castle's, I don't know, it's because when I watch a William Castle movie, I think of it as, I don't know, I like them better, and to me they're better done, like, in retrospect than some of Corman's stuff. Or is that just me?
I guess what I was trying to get at is they're both reverse sides of a coin, where I think that William Castle, he went in a much more studio direction with the types of movies he wanted to make.
Well, he spent a little more time making them once he could, you know, instead of making a movie a week, he could take 20 days or whatever to make those movies. He's still working fairly low budget, but I think there's a much more sense of whimsy and fun to William Castle films.
Mm-hmm. Versus like the Roger Corman, like, you know, just get it out. You know, make it as quick as possible.
It is crank it out. I mean, we've done lots of Corman, and I mean, I don't want to bag on Corman because he's given us some good material over the years.
What's the quantity over quality, possibly?
Well, yeah.
I think William Castle's have a higher concept more often.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the concept of them is great, which is why you would remake them. Because
they do,
like,
have great concepts. I mean, even the whole thing of how he had an uncle who collected ghosts, that's a very intriguing setup for a movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and he could have easily, like, he went out of his way to make each ghost somewhat unique and identifiable. Now, the remake goes even a step further than that. But, you know, at least there's something unique about each one of them that you can kind of identify. You get that in front of you there, Jeff? Because you actually brought it up before. It's as well defined. They didn't go out of their way to define each of the ghosts and kind of give hints of their backstories. But you can kind of see what happened with these ghosts, somewhat history. And again, that's something the remake does and embraces in their ghost designs, is you can see the mythology within the ghosts. So, I mean, you got the lion tamer and the lion. I don't know what happened to the lion. I'm guessing the lion was put down after biting the head off his trainer. So that's that story. I think
they're all on the poster.
I think Bobby tells the story of the chef when he walks in on the ghost going crazy in the kitchen.
He does.
There's like a burning skeleton.
There's the burning skeleton.
There's a hanging woman. Actually, that was one that was the one where I was like, oh, this is a little intense. Where there's two hanging women, I think.
And there was that more monstrous one. The big hands. I'm not sure. I guess that would have been a horrible, diseased ghost.
Then there's the cloaked one. Well, yeah, there's the cloaked one with really big hands. Like, there was, he talks about the chef earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think was like, wasn't that like a murder-suicide thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
It was two murders and a suicide, I think. Because it was like his mother-in-law and his wife and some of the... He did not like women. He killed like three women and then he died. That was the chef.
I'll say though, like all of the ghosts... I think if you take all of the ghost scenes from this movie and then take the end credits from Duckula, that's just my aesthetic in life.
That's funny. But the ghosts, at least with Bobby, they just seemed like they were trying to entertain him. He was an audience.
Yeah.
There some of the more gruesome stuff, they were trying to freak out Cyrus. Knives being hucked at his head and the burning ghost coalescing in that big pinwheel coming towards him was really freaking him out. The fact that he kind of got out of it and was... Every time they had the encounter, he'd be screaming, and then it would be like, eh.
I think it's because, like... He was working in a museum and he was a paleontologist, and I don't think they played enough into the fact that, like, he's a quote-unquote man of science and this shouldn't make sense. And I thought that would have been like more of a cooler, like, they don't show that conflict as much as I think they probably should, or what you're supposed to interpret from his reaction to things.
Yeah, well, and his boss kind of gets in on the research acts, not really questioning it all that much. Honestly, the research into that Latin book, it's just there to trickle out information to the audience along the way. It really doesn't matter whether Van Allen believes them or not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wish there was more information in the book, if I'm really honest. Like you say, they show the pictures of the ghosts at the beginning, and I would really have loved to learn more as we went along.
Yeah, and that's something that... I wish was in both movies. Like, when I think about these two movies and how unique the ghosts are, I want to know more of their backstory. Like, you can get hints at it by just looking at them and seeing how they died or what they look like when they died. Like, you know, a hanging woman. Okay, well, what's the story that leads up to that? Now, you can find some of that on the remake one with the DVD. There's some backstory that's narrated by F. Murray Abraham, who plays Cyrus Kritikos, and he tells the backstory briefly. They're only like a minute or two each of the 12 ghosts. And I said 12 on purpose. We'll get there.
Yes.
it's a different angle there. Well, it's actually 12. Both of them start out with 12.
Yeah. And the
hook.
13 burned on him, which is...
Yeah,
they sort of just let go of that later.
Well, there's hints it could be anybody, really, because at one point the planchette is pointing at Medea as the next person to die. Then it was Cyrus who gets the 13 burned into his hand when he picks up the book in another hidden chamber.
Right?
And interesting, he had the sliding door in there. So he goes in, he wants to leave, slide shut.
And then the ghosts show up.
Until the ghosts had enough with him, and then they let him go. But the sliding door certainly comes into effect in the remake when it takes and bisects the lawyer. One of the coolest cutting in half scenes I've ever seen in a movie, because it's not like, hey, cutting him in half through the waist. It's like through his sides, so you're getting this perfect cross-section. So, you know, his front slides down while his back is still sticking to the other side of the glass. It was really wild.
Yeah, it's like way better than like the same type thing in that movie with Christian Bale where they outlaw emotion.
With the guns. I'm trying to remember what that one's called. I really like that movie too.
Damn, I was gonna come up with a snappy quip.
And there's also one in that one with Leonardo DiCaprio and J-Lo called The Cell, where there's actually, it's not a person, but they have a whole thing where like it's a horse and they have these like kind of glass blades come down and like separate it. I remember that visual very clearly because it was so wild and weird.
Yeah,
it's something I love seeing in animation that I think it's done a lot because it's something that's easy to get away with. But seeing it done in a movie, like this is, I think, my favorite version of the cutting someone in half and seeing all of their insides.
Yeah. And he was there for quite some time. I love him when they find him later and he's still slumped over. Oh, that's what happened to him.
I wondered why his back half was so sticky. Like, his front half still has blood in it, but it just slides right off.
I don't know. There's a lawyer joke in there somewhere that is not coming out.
Absolutely. I don't know. There's a glass cleaning joke that really needs to go on about this movie. How much Windex? How much Windex?
They must have blown through a shit ton of Windex on that set, because I mean, it's a glass house. I never had so much sympathy for a cinematographer in my life, because the reflections in a movie of that sort, like if you going in there thinking, eh, shitty movie or whatever, and not appreciating the fucking effort that took.
Yes.
To get those angles right and not catch any crew in a reflection. Everybody's wearing black to minimize reflection, and goddamn that, and to get that right must have been so hard, and there's probably a reason why they've never done it again.
the remake was really, I think it's rare when you watch a movie and you really feel the cinematographer come through, maybe more than the director. And I feel like I really could with the remake for 13 Ghosts. Even just in the opening sequence where it's like the single take shot of panning past Tony Shalhoub with his wife, and then like all of the sound effects, and the house gets like progressively shittier. And,
that history, the way
it was a cool shot. That's like a cinematographer thing, I think. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it was a really interesting way to tell his backstory, as his family had kind of crumbled around him because of this fire. I'll actually tell that story real quick. His wife died in a fire. It was because of a log that had rolled out of the fireplace near the Christmas tree, and then dry Christmas tree goes up and poof. And they thought they got the whole family out, but the wife's still missing. He tries to go back in, the firemen won't let him, and she burns to death. She also becomes the fourth ghost in the Black Zodiac. We'll get there. We will get there. I can't wait to talk about the Black Zodiac. With the original film, the lawyer, he's after the money, and I thought it was hilarious that every time the kid slid down the banister, his ass would pay out.
Yes. I thought that was so funny. I'm like, where is it coming from?
Yeah, I literally thought money was coming out of his ass. I'm like, what the hell, dude? Your son is the golden goose.
Exactly. Now, son, also, you just slide down that banister until I tell you to stop.
The kid in the remake was fun. It was really fun when he was recording the morning news at the breakfast table. He was like, a local woman has been decapitated.
Yeah. Yeah, a very dark little child. But yeah, it was quite interesting. Speaking of the children, though. In both
Oh, no. Movies, here we go again.
No.
Oh, okay. Good.
There's a giant age gap between the oldest and the youngest, to me. Well,
like, I don't know.
It
I mean,
feels like, I'm sorry, Shannon Elizabeth in the remake, I'm guessing she looks, I know she's supposed to probably be playing a teenager.
She's
22.
Yeah, no, she's playing a teenager. I mean, keep in mind, Shannon Elizabeth is just a few months younger than me. She was actually a year older than the nanny.
That's exactly it. They look the same age. She's supposed to be playing a teenager. And I'm like going, no, that woman's like in her 20s.
Yeah, no, she, I mean, yes, Shannon Elizabeth looks good and probably looked younger than she was, but come on.
Not a teenager.
No, she had already passed teenage years at that point.
She's like 12 years older than her younger brother. That's a big gap. And also with Medea in the original, I felt there was a huge gap between her and her brother, too.
I mean, I feel like I don't really notice as much because my older sister is 9 years older than me.
Oh, yeah. Then I guess, yeah. My experience has not been, like, unless there's been a large group of kids, and it's, like, between the fourth and the second, or first, that there's that huge of a gap.
No, like, it's just me and my sister and then my younger brother.
It's not unusual, especially in 60s movies and television shows, where you'd have somebody in their mid-20s playing, like, 16, 17. But it was a little weird with the remake. Yeah,
the remake is so glaring. That's well, what bothers the thing me is, so
it wouldn't have been. It wouldn't have minded if a little bit of dialogue had slipped in there saying she was sticking around.
Yeah.
To help raise her little brother, so and right? keep the family solvent because dad's struggling, and there's a distance between Tony Shalhoub's character and his kids. Like he, yes. when his son goes missing, he's off. We gotta go find the kid. We gotta go find the kid. You call your son the kid? Like it bugged me so much. I love that movie, but that every time I watch it, I'm like, why do you keep calling your son the kid?
Yeah,
it just drove me nuts.
Yeah.
Just, you know, if he calls his son a name, then one day then he might lose him.
Yeah, he might start caring about him.
But, you know, when caring about people, they're going to die in fires, and you can't do that.
Yeah.
Well, you might have something there that might have been done on purpose, maybe. Is to have that emotional distance. But we never heard him. It's like, where's the daughter? where's the other kid? The one that's clearly not a kid.
I could see something like, you know, after his wife dies, because you do get the impression that he was like happy and, you know, a family man and stuff. And after his wife died, he like withdrew from the world. But
yeah,
I could see something how he has known his daughter for longer. So that's less of a relationship he needs to think about versus like he could withdraw from both of them. But there's still going to be a greater security with his daughter because, you know, just time.
Yeah. It was just weird because it felt like there was maybe an emotional story that got cut because of time restrictions or whatever. But an emotional growth where he learns, you know, it's like, hey, I got to watch out for my... He was never a neglectful dad, but he was a struggling one. And,
no, he was having trouble, what was weird is I thought he should have been closer to his son because he seemed to like more resemble his son. Shannon Elizabeth looks in no way like she should be his daughter. Just saying.
I gotta disagree with you. Well, I mean, I do agree with you there, but she's actually is from Arabic descent, just Tony Shalhoub. So
I'm just saying, facially wise, like when you look at people and they're cast, and they're cast to look like they should. Gary family traits, like her nose is different, her chin is different, like it doesn't look.
When you think about this movie, she technically was the one with the most star power in that film.
Yeah,
at the time, I mean, she was the it girl of the late 90s. Whoa. So
Matthew Lillard, hello.
Yeah,
he was already. I would say his career was already kind of starting to go into a slump and didn't kind of pick up again until Scooby-Doo kind of resurrected it a little bit. But well, I'd say he was in a bit of a slump here. He was great in this movie, though.
Definitely. He's great in everything.
The cloud of M. Beth Davids, who was in Schindler's List.
Yeah, we'll go through the cast right after the trailer, which I will run right now.
There are ghosts around us all the time. Most of them, they can't hurt us. Most of them don't even want to hurt us. But there are exceptions.
Is it bad tonight?
Oh, bad? It is my professional opinion. We should get the hell out of here. Now.
I represent the estate of your Uncle Cyrus.
We have an Uncle Cyrus?
Cyrus recorded this message 6 weeks ago. He asked it to be played for you in the event of his death.
Arthur, I've instructed my lawyer to deliver my last will and testament.
A key?
A key to what?
A key to your new house. This house is the fruit of my life's work.
Oh my God.
It is a one-of-a-kind home.
It's marvelous, isn't it? Arthur, we've got some papers to sign in the library. After that, I would love to take you and the family around on a tour of the house.
This place is awesome!
All right, now I know I'm dreaming.
Well, your uncle was quite a collector of many things.
What the hell was that?
This Halloween.
You're wasting your time. It's all sealed up.
The only thing worse than being trapped in a house with a ghost.
This house is not a house. We're in the middle of a machine, powered by the devil.
dead.
Is being trapped in a house with 13 ghosts.
Maggie!
What?
We got company.
Where? I can't see.
How close is it?
Close enough to hurt you. Go, go, go! Go.
Can I rely on you not to get me killed?
I guarantee nothing.
Okay, that was the trailer for 13 Ghosts from 2001 by director Steve Beck. Screenplay was by Neil Marshall. Nope, not that one. Stevens. I probably should have put that last bit in there. Who did such hits as Murder Cycle?
Oh, my God. Title. Great title. We have to do that for our titles thing.
Yeah. Also co-written by Richard Doevideo, who wrote Exit Wounds, which was actually shot in our hometown here of Calgary.
Yep.
Was, yeah, that's like one of the right better. By the bridge in that movie is by my house.
Yeah, it was one of the better Steven Seagal movies, actually. Uncredited script assists go to Todd Alcott, who wrote Ants, and I think everybody's going to know James Gunn, who also did writing assists on this, uncredited, and most famous for Guardians of the Galaxy these days, upcoming Suicide Squad sequel, Slither, and we talked about him in episode 3. Yes, that long ago, episode 3, when we were talking about Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Yeah. And how could we forget he would reunite with Matthew Lillard on Scooby-Doo? Yes.
That's correct. And directed by Steve Beck, who directed another of the Dark House, who produced this film, Ghost Ship. And Dark House remade House on Haunted Hill. They kind of initially were remaking William Castle films, but you know, they did things like Rock and Roll as well, so they eventually branched out to other things. Yeah. Starring Tony Shalhoub, easily best known for his role as Monk, the self-titled TV show, and he was also in
Everywhere
and Galaxy Quest for our sci-fi fans,
and Wings
TV show, yeah,
I watched again recently.
That yeah. guy from Spy Kids,
yeah. Great, great actor. Always fun to watch. Shannon Elizabeth, most famous for the American Pie movies, played the daughter, Kathy Kritikos. M. Beth Davids was Kalina Ortizia. And we actually talked about her just a couple weeks ago in episode 238 when we talked about the girl with the dragon tattoo. Now that we've done that movie, it comes up every week.
Yeah.
And she was also in Army of Darkness.
And Schindler's List.
She's been in some a cool mix of stuff, really.
Yes.
But her character is such a weird one because at the beginning of the film, she is what I call a spirits rights activist.
Pretty much.
Her and this other character named Damon, and trying to stop F. Murray Abrams' Cyrus Kritikos from capturing these ghosts. They should be free ghosts to do what they do, except what these particular violent ghosts do is kill people, especially yeah. the one at the beginning.
See, I didn't get that. Like, the whole thing is like the ghost should be free, but I had an idea where they should have been free for them to, I don't know, push him into the actual afterlife. I thought that was a better idea.
Well, and I don't understand why there's this whole song and dance of them showing up with trying to stop him. When she's Cyrus's lover.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are you performing this act for?
I can't figure out her motivations at all.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. Nope. She's just kind of an extra character so they can have an extra body. When you think about this movie, though, there's only one character that dies at a hand of a ghost outside of that massacre at the beginning.
True.
Yeah.
The beginning kind of made me think of Jurassic Park a little bit. Not as good, obviously, but I feel like there was a strong influence there.
I totally get it. I can totally see it with just the carnage, and they're like somebody doing something incredibly stupid with something very dangerous.
Continuing on with the cast here, we got Matthew Lillard as Dennis Rafkin. He's in one of my favorites, Hackers, famous for Scream and, of course, Scooby-Doo. And he plays a psychic who tracks down these ghosts for Cyrus Criticos. It also causes him a lot of physical pain coming into contact with these people, with these past people. Alec Roberts was Bobby Criticos, the son, and he would go on to be in Traffic. J.R. Bourne was Benjamin Moss, the lawyer in this movie, another Benjamin. Didn't get as cool of a name as Rush, though. Yeah. And people will recognize him for the 100 off of television, and primarily season 6 and 7 of that show. Rod Digga, most famous for being a musician rather than actress, but she did a capable job as the nanny in this movie as Maggie Bess.
A lot of her lines, you know, I was really wondering about this, and this is pure speculation. This is her first movie. She's a rapper who's trying to kickstart an acting career. I feel like a lot of her lines are, like, I think she tries to deliver them a lot funnier than they should be delivered. Like, I feel like she really, really tried to just, like, act the hell out of those punchlines as much as she could.
She was technically supposed to be the comic relief, like, hey, I don't do windows, and that little bit at the end. This nanny gig sucks.
He was doing an LL Cool J.
Yeah.
He's known, like, he was in the Halloween
AQO,
and, like, he was the comic relief, and it's like, oh, this is my job here. I'm doing this now.
That brief period of time when just rappers were just in movies because they could be, and kids like rappers.
Of course, we're continuing on with the cast here. F. Murray Abraham was Cyrus Criticos, the uncle whose machinations gather the family into this big glass house. We talked about him last time in episode 178 when we remade The Last Action Hero. Matthew Harrison was Damon, and you can catch him in the film version of The Watchmen. And I'm not going to get into the people who played the ghosts. There's mainly stunt actors, and in some cases this was their only film, and others went on to some half-decent careers. But you can do your own research on them, because there's 12 of them. But the one thing I do like is that this film is that the ghosts are all done practically, with the exception of the torso that has some minimal CGI. Obviously, you have to remove the head. And you can't do that to a real actor. So they digitally removed his head, but his legs were gone. He was a double amputee who played that character.
You know, some of the character design, I don't know if it's just because Glenn Danzig just had a movie that came out that's been making me think of his comics, but some of the character design makes me think of, you know, like Glenn Danzig had this, like, very, I'm going to say, it's, you know what I'm talking about, where it from his comics, the characters
he likes sex and violence
ghosts look like his comics.
I'm gonna disagree
to 130%.
Maybe the Angry Princess is the only one that really would remind me of one,
like,
of his.
The other dude where it's
these all felt like Cenobites to me. Like, these felt like they would have been right at home in a Hellraiser movie to me,
especially the hammer, the one with all the spikes in him.
Yeah,
like a 2000s Hellraiser movie maybe.
Yeah, no, I thought the designs were cool as fuck, for the most part. I thought they were, and their backstories are wild. I just wanted to know more, but that's why I like this movie so much, is I really just was engaged with these guys. When you first see the Juggernaut at the beginning, and you see all these holes in him, and you know the story, like, he's gunned down, like, a lot, because he would not stop. And he was the same in death as he was in life. He would not stop. Should we break down the ghosts? Do you want to break down the ghosts? Okay, we got 12 ghosts. Might as well, and we can get into this as we go, because, again, the family, the Criticoses, inherit the house, and this is a big manipulation on the part of Cyrus, who we see die at the beginning of the film. And I remember seeing this theater the first time I saw it, and I'm like, oh, he's not dead.
Yeah.
Mainly because he's a very recognizable and big actor in F. Murray Abraham. You're not going to get somebody that big not to have him show up again.
But
so
in Scream, Drew Barrymore was at the beginning. They were having this whole thing where, like, big famous people would show up and then die real quickly.
True. Mm-hmm.
That's true. I mean, it could have gone that way. It sets up a mystery that's pretty obvious. And we start seeing Ephemeria Abraham's ghost appearing, but he's not actually dead. The 13th ghost winds up, it's supposed to be Tony Shalhoub's character, Arthur, and as a truly benevolent spirit, a good spirit, as to counterbalance these really evil ones, to sacrifice himself to save his family. He's supposed to be the 13th ghost to power this engine that was designed by the devil and powered by the dead. There's a quote I really loved. But the 13th ghost, in my mind, is actually Matthew Lillard, because he actually shows up as a ghost. He's the only one who dies out of the main cast by a ghost's hands. A kind of a tag team between the Hammer and the Juggernaut. Talk about rock and hard place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, the one thing, the 13th Ghost remake, it's very dated. Not necessarily in a bad way, but it's very interesting how, you know, being in the 2000s, you didn't necessarily see certain things that would become very, very much hallmarks of that era. Mm-hmm. And 13 Ghosts is very much that type of movie.
The CGI doesn't stand up as well as it did, but you know, it's like the 60s stuff doesn't stand up either, but it's a movie of its time, and you can start to see that with this one as well. This is a very action movie, music video type of film.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
So
you do get a very music video feel by each ghost.
There was quite a bit of that kind of going on in the early 2000s with Resident Evil, House on Haunted Hill. They kind of feel like that, right? They're very rock and roll.
Definitely. A little bit video game cutscene-y at times, maybe.
Yeah.
So, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
Not in a bad way.
Like the one thing I like, like I said, the ghosts are there on set. They're practical. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Handled with quick cuts and things like that. They look really cool. So it's not, it doesn't, none of them come off cheesy because of CGI or whatever, because they try to keep that to a fair minimum in the films. Thank God.
It is an example of early digital editing, though, where they just, early on, where Matthew Lillard is psychic, and then there's like a flash of a scary picture with a scary sound.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, this is going to be one of those types of scary movies.
Well, you'd think it'd keep the budget down, but I mean, the budget of the movie was like $42 million, so it wasn't that cheap. But I guess the set of that big glass house probably wasn't cheap to build. It was something else. It was a pretty intricate thing that they built there. It was quite something to look at, and it was really cool looking.
It felt
completely
big.
Impractical,
felt expensive.
But yeah, it felt big and expensive because of it. But I mean, if you're shooting in a big set, it certainly makes it stand out. It's unique, if nothing else. Okay,
all
let's.
All the glass with all that writing on them.
Yeah, yeah, all that glass with the etchings are meant to keep the ghosts at bay behind them. Okay, so the 12 ghosts, the Black Zodiac that they've put together here to power this engine in this house. And the purpose of this is to give Cyrus ultimate power, whatever that power is. Who the fuck knows?
ultimate power.
Yeah, it's like, what's in the briefcase? Yeah, who knows? I'm like, I hate when they give us like, okay, well, so he's power hungry, but what was he actually getting? I don't know. Yeah. Gift certificate to Walmart, to Sizzler.
Hey, this is a podcast. I don't know if you guys can understand. It's ultimate power, capital U, capital P, you guys.
Okay, so the first ghost is the firstborn son. This is the ghost with the arrow in his head, the little boy. And basically his story, he loved playing cowboys and Indians, and he would have tantrums if he wasn't in his costume or wasn't playing cowboys and Indians, and he was always the cowboy. And a neighbor kid found a real bow and arrow, and yeah, next thing you know, that arrow's in the middle of his head.
Ooh.
The second ghost was the torso. The second ghost was the torso, and he was the gambler who didn't pay his debts, and the mob came after him, and they wrapped him all in plastic and cut off his limbs and dumped him in the ocean. I love that these backstories exist. Now, you can kind of get hints by looking at the ghost, but if you don't watch the special features on the disc, you don't know these backstories.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
For the one with the backstory where he was dumped in the ocean, where did he have to go, like, out in the middle of the ocean to get him? Because that would have been cool to see, because, like, ghost capturing in the ocean?
I don't know. You know, you see the ghosts were kind of residing where they most existed in life. Like, the Juggernaut, he was a serial killer who brought his victims to this yard that they found his ghost in. So he was bringing women there to murder. He buys with his bare hands. He would tear them apart, and then the police tracked him down and shoved a lot of bullets into him. And once he finally went down, they shot him again 50 more times. They just
so
kept
the torso was like they were ghost hunting at a casino. I got
you. I would think. I mean, they don't give you that kind of backstory, right? They're just telling the personal story of these guys. So as far as where Criticos found them, I don't know. The bound woman was the cheerleader character. And she was hung by her boyfriend because she was sleeping around. And there's a good quote in that. I highly recommend people watch these special features. They're pretty cool. You can find them on YouTube as well. And yeah, he buried her in the football field. He's like, the bitch had it coming. The withered.
You're finding this just way too funny. You're just like, man, this great, hilarious story.
It is great. I love that they went through this kind of depth when that's how they designed them. That's what they handed these descriptions off to the special effects people at K&B, and it really helped them to design these characters.
Yeah.
The withered lover was the wife of Tony Shalhoub's character, Arthur, and she's died in the fire, and she's the fourth ghost. Because she's carrying the IV. Get it?
Yeah.
Roman numerals?
Yeah.
Okay. How long can you carry the groan? Number five was the Torn Prince. He was the one with the baseball bat. He had aspirations of being a professional ball player. But was also a real asshole. And it caught up with him. And he
some ghosts are assholes, guys.
Well, what happened was he was racing in a drag race. He existed in the 50s, and he went off the edge of the road and died in the crash, in the fire. That's why he's so torn up. Number six was the Angry Princess, the hot, naked girl with all the scars.
The Angry Princess was a young woman whose beauty became her ruin. Dana Newman was blessed with the natural looks of a goddess, but cursed with an inability to recognize it. Her vanity and insecurity was only fueled by a string of abusive boyfriends. By the time of her 20s, depression had dragged Dana into a downward spiral of self-loathing that doctors struggled to save her from. Her desperate search for perfection led to employment with a plastic surgeon, where her wage was paid in nose jobs, breast implants, and an endless array of other needless procedures. Alone in the office one night, Dana tried to perform surgery on herself in a desperate attempt to remove an unperceivable imperfection on her face. The unorthodox procedure went horribly wrong, and she was left blinded in one eye. She finally gave up on achieving perfection and mutilated herself in a bathtub until her veins ran dry. When they found her, they said that she was as beautiful in death as she was in life.
She gave up on this search of perfection and committed suicide in the bathtub. That's why we see her go to the bathtub in the house later on once she's freed and it's covered in blood and there says, "I'm sorry." On the floor. You get hints of their stories, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. The scars on her body, very indicative of like cutting herself apart for plastic surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that was kind of what she did in her final bits. The pilgrimess. I don't. Bits.
In multiple terms, she's cut up.
Poor girl. Her makeup job was actually the longest out of all the ghosts. A little over four hours.
Was it a full prosthetic suit or was it applied?
She was naked.
Yeah. That's a whole body. It takes a long time.
And that was her only role, too. I would say that was probably enough for anybody.
Oh, yeah. You've gone through shit.
Yeah.
Just doing makeup that long, you know, that's a long time just to stand and not do anything and have other people just like prod at you.
Yeah. The pilgrimess, essentially, she was the ghost that was in the stocks, and she was captured under being falsely accused as a witch, and then eventually burned as well. A lot of them were burned. The Great Child was number eight, and number nine was the Dire Mother. This is a crazy story between these two. The Dire Mother's like just a couple feet tall. She's a little woman. and was taken in by this circus, and was a horrible life being put on display as a circus freak. And then she was raped by the tall man, which resulted in this deformed baby of the great child. Eventually, some of the other freaks take her away, and she dies and smothered. And then the great child just grabs a couple axes and goes on a rampage and kills them all and puts all their bodies on display for the guests to the carnival to see before he was killed by the owner of the carnival.
You kill my mom, and one of you raped her. I'm probably going to do this.
Crazy story. Number 10.
You know, it's like a lot of the backstories for these ghosts have kind of, you know, they're really pulpy, kind of have an old EC, Tales from the Crypt kind of vibe to them.
Mm-hmm. Number 10 was the Hammer, and he was a blacksmith who was falsely accused of a crime.
George Markley was a happy, honest blacksmith in the early 1890s before the horrific events that transformed him into the Hammer. A hard-working man named Nathan wrongfully accused Mr. Markley of stealing and threatened to run him out of their booming town. Knowing he was innocent, George stood up to Nathan and refused to move. One day, when George's wife and two children were walking home from the market, Nathan and his gang of thugs attacked them, brutally killing them. Enraged, George tracked down Nathan and his friends and beat them to a pulp with his massive blacksmith's hammer. The local townspeople captured George and dragged him back to his shop, where he received a brutal form of frontier justice. Tied to a tree, nails were driven deep into his body with his own hammer. They finished the job by cutting off his most prized possession, his hand. Crudely fastened to his severed appendage was the tool of his livelihood, the hammer, readied for one last chance at vengeance.
Really awful story. So in a way, he was kind of a heroic character that died terribly. The Jackal's probably one of the scariest ones in the film, because he's really rabid and wild. He had this predilection of killing prostitutes and committed himself, so at least he knew he had a problem. And just completely lost his mind while he was in the asylum, and they could not control him, and they put that cage over his face.
Oh, that's who that is. Okay.
Yeah, and to keep him from biting and scratching, and you can see he has no nails from trying to claw at the walls. It was a really crazy story, and then the asylum burned down, and he never left the asylum, but you could see where the cage probably got hot enough for him to pull it open, because it's the face of it's open.
Yeah.
So there's a really cool story there. And with each of these ghosts, I would love to just see like an episode dedicated to their history. This would be a great 13-episode series.
Yeah.
And the final one is the Juggernaut, which I already said. He's the serial killer who tore apart his victims. So
yeah, including all those people who came to get him. Because they said, didn't he do so many during life?
And I think they said he, because the psychic thought he'd only killed 9 people, but there was like 40 bodies there. And he's like, well, we never said he stopped.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that whole scene with the junkyard, that was very reminiscent for me of Nightmare on Elm Street as well, actually. Like the third sequels. Yeah, the third one, and then also, I think, the beginning of the fourth. Yeah, and also the fifth.
Right. Was the junkyard still in the fifth? I don't think it was in the fifth.
I think that they go back at some point in the fifth.
I don't recall.
I don't know. I'd have to go back either.
Ooh, but it was reminiscent.
It made me think of Nightmare on Elm Street a little bit.
Right.
Well, this is kind of the opening where you find out Matthew Lillard, when he's like touching stuff, he gets all these moments, and they do it on later in the movie where Tony Shalhoub touches him and he kind of experiences like this whole thing again. And like, holy crap, what a shitty like kind of life where you touch people and like all you get is the crap that they do. So sad. So very sad. I felt bad for him. I did.
You know, that family as a whole, I don't know. There's no chemistry as a family there.
No. Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't. Yeah, he's desperately looking for Bobby, but I don't get the feeling he gives a shit about the kid that much, because he can't call him by name very often. We got to find the kid. We got to find the kid.
Tony Shalhoub maybe just couldn't remember the kid's name. we gotta find Billy. It's not Billy. We gotta find The kid. Just get me the kid.
Go with it. We got nothing else. So, there's this big reveal with Cyrus at the end once Tony Shalhoub starts counting with his fingers the ghosts after they've been called away to this room, this spinning room. Basically, this ceremony and his family has been captured and put in the center of this, and he's meant to jump through these spinning blades to go rescue them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure when he actually does and doesn't get torn apart, why suddenly the blades stop.
Yeah.
But I guess that's just magic. Magic.
Well, Matthew Lillard shows up, so I was just hoping that maybe Matthew Lillard was like, oh, okay, I'll give you an opening. That would have worked.
But, I mean, once Maggie messes with the tape with all the spells on it, and the ghosts start freeing themselves, and then all 12 huck him into the engine, and he just gets obliterated. I love a good kill. That's why I chuckle when they get killed, because when I reading out the deaths and stuff, because like it's a horror movie, and I love a good kill. Like I don't want it to happen in real life, but it's a really fun kill on film. Like, this movie's fun. There's a lot of shit in here doesn't make fucking sense.
Oh, true. But it's also a comeuppance kill, so it feels very satisfying.
I do actually feel like there's a lot of elements of this movie that if it was stripped back like 25%, would be a better movie. Like, it's just a little bit too convoluted, but it's still fun.
Well, and all the stuff they don't say, like, you're making assumptions by looking at these ghosts, and until you hit the special features you don't get into their histories or whatever, and that's the stuff I really found fascinating, is like, these ghosts are really cool. Why are they look the way they look?
Actually, I thought that I expected, actually, from a remake after watching the original, that they would lean more into the ghost collector aspect and less a like harnessing ghost energy for occult science purposes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you look at it as a remake, I mean, they kept the house. They kept a guy who was collecting ghosts. In this case, it was for more nefarious purposes. I'm not even sure why the doctor in the original was gathering the ghosts up in the first place.
I think it was just like I got the sense it was just he's a bit eccentric. He has money. Why not collect ghosts? He's like hunted every animal, or he's collected every, rare, Charles Dickens paperback or something.
He's playing a cult Pokemon.
Yeah, exactly. He just goes to his rich people party and he says, hey, Gerald, how many ghosts do you have?
Yeah.
Four?
Oh, I got 12. There's this really cool bit at the beginning when the lawyer visits Tony Shalhoub's family, and Shannon Elizabeth's like, oh, I didn't know he had Uncle Cyrus. Oh, yeah, he had squandered the family fortune. We have a family fortune? Well, no, he squandered it.
Right?
Yeah.
What did I
No, there was a bunch of moments of this movie where I was like, was some of the intention of this movie to be like more of a comedy than the edit of the movie was?
Yeah.
Well, I feel like there was a lot of like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this, and wouldn't it be cool if we did that, and the whole movie kind of watches that way.
Yeah.
But the story, once you start throwing it out there, it doesn't hold up. I mean, at least with the original, you don't really have much of a backstory. It's like, oh, eccentric uncle who gave us a house, and it's filled with ghosts, but we don't get to keep it if we leave, and then it goes to the county or whatever. So they're kind of forced to stay, but that's about it. And then it reverts to, finding the money and keeping the secret of finding the money and doing the Scooby-Doo gag of playing monster and trying to scare the family out of the house.
Yeah.
It was really Benjamin Rush.
Oh, word for you, meddling kids. But in the remake, like, I don't know, like, the house, it's a cool idea conceptually, but when you're in it, you're like, would you want to live in a place like that? Like, I know that the bathroom has like kind of just those glass kind of cubes that are supposed to block stuff, but I don't want to shit in a glass room. I really don't.
It's like,
I don't want to bathe in a glass room either.
It's like, you're
I'm not shy. I'm cool with it.
You have payments. You have payments that you can't pay, your mortgages, whatever. You want to come live in a lab?
Yeah.
I mean, if it wasn't for all of the nasty killing ghosts, I would have been cool with that. That place was awesome, but it's like, oh, where do I hang a poster that's not awkward? Where do I, like, can't hang
See, this? That's where original movie posters come in handy, because then, like, you can see it from both sides.
One nail. And then the whole house crumbles.
Just a lot of sticky tack.
Yeah. I'm guessing that's why it was kind of in the middle of a forested area, because, you know, one asshole, glass house, got to throw the stone.
But
I mean, they go out of their way to say, hey, this is a strong, this isn't normal glass, and it's protective of from the ghosts, and it's soundproof, and it's really strong.
But then there's the whole thing, too. Like, if it rains, if it fucking rains, and then you've got mud around, and then there's water spots, like, this house is a goddamn nightmare.
Oh, yeah. No, as far as... Oh, you mean just walking around in your bare feet?
Yes.
Oh, God. You'd need a staff of 20 just to clean all the fucking handprints and feet prints and...
You know what? Everything else aside, imagine... I don't know, you know, what part of the world they're in, but, you know, we all live in central Alberta. Imagine the summers, like, with the sun.
Oh, you would die.
Yeah.
Again, I guess that's where the trees come in. I'm guessing it had a covered roof or something.
Yeah, but I mean, from the sides, you still get it. I wonder if you could get, like...
They had those metal shutters, if he learned how to use the metal shutters.
But I kept thinking, isn't there those glasses you can get that go dark and sunglassy when you hit light?
Yeah. Why is it the two big haunted house movies from Dark House had, like, these haunted houses that had horrible shutters on them to lock people in? Yeah. House on Haunted Hill was like that too. I mean, it wasn't
Somebody
as elaborate.
Has the fear of it.
Like, yeah. I'm like, this house is a little too secure.
Right? This is how I die. Yeah, somebody's what's the word? It's not agoraphobic, it's the opposite of that.
They actually might be perfect COVID houses, though.
Claustrophobic. Oh, yeah, it's a good COVID house.
It's a good way to lock yourself in. So you order takeout, and you don't even have to open the door. Just show it to me. Yeah, that's my order. Just leave it there. Leave it there.
Exactly. Yeah. I will come out and
walk away. You're going to wave them away. Walk away. Walk. Go. Go.
The five or six people who make more than a $1 billion who listen to this podcast.
Where are my dumplings? I wasn't done.
Exactly. But they're like, what are you talking about? This is just my everyday problem.
You Next know how time you I make a delivery, can you put on...
Just do it.
Next time I make a delivery to the glass house, please put on pants.
Yes. I'm imagining some guy just, like, in tidy whities, just scratched himself as he gets to the door.
I'm going to make that dorm is going to... That place is going to be a dorm for supermodels, and then it'll be nothing but teenage boys hanging out.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, too much glass. Not good. But I also wondered, too, is, like, the ghosts are held by spells, and they're, like, they have to be particularly strong. And it always made me wonder, like, you know how lawyers are always looking for loopholes? If there was, like, a lawyer ghost that's just always looking for loopholes.
Well, it's a good concept.
They missed their opportunity with the bisected lawyer, because he died in the house.
That's maybe why he wasn't there. He knew how to get out, because he's like, well, this says this, but if you interpret it this way, I don't have to do that.
I love the irony that his own greed, the lawyer's greed, so he still was much like the original Benjamin in that regard, goes to get this payment, and it's just this elaborate trap that sets off the clockwork that locks everybody in. Yep. I'm like, oh, you've apparently never seen an Indiana Jones movie. Just got to swap it out with something that's equally weighty.
You know, sometimes I watch these movies and I know that this is definitely putting a level onto these movies that a lot of movies can't bear because they weren't designed for it. But I think, you know, putting myself in the shoes of that man whose house that was, you know, it's like, if I had this money, you know, I'm going to make these decisions about where I live. I'm going to, you know, I think it'd be a good idea to add this trap here. Sure, I'll get the contractors to do it next week. You know,
Yeah, who built that monstrosity?
Right?
Like,
I mean, because it, like, all the panels have to move, and then there's like several.
It's all where, clockwork, like, too. So,
like, wished.
If this was built out of some occult book, what do they call it? The Arcanum Infernus? Or something like that?
Oculus Infernum, which is like the eye of hell or something like that.
Yeah, so this Arcanum was... So you would figure that it would be this ancient spellbook. So this clockwork thing technically was designed, you know, hundreds of years ago, maybe, in this ancient spellbook.
See, when you're doing that, this is another bit that kind of bothered me, is like when you're talking about, like, it's from that long ago and it's sort of a machine and you have all this glass. I thought it would, like, be light-based, like, you know, where you have the clock. You do the solar clock.
I think it's just entirely because glass looks expensive.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
I think that falls into my rule of everything in this movie is supposed to look cool, but never mind if it... don't look behind the curtain that closely.
This is like, hey guys, and don't make any mistake. We have a ghost who's just a woman who has boobs, and there's a rapper in this movie. Just come on. We have everything kids like.
Yep. Honestly, until I researched this, I had no idea who she was. I'm like, oh, the rapper.
Me neither. I listen to a lot of rap music, and I feel like I'm not surprised I haven't come across her music before.
She did a lot of soundtrack work, so maybe that's kind of where she went.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Made those connections.
Maybe. Well, it might be time for us to get out of here, because, you know, the ghosts are trying to scare us away. They're getting out.
The clock is kicking down.
Any last thoughts about 13 Ghosts?
I really enjoyed the 1960s version.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have liked to have seen more of the ghosts in that.
Yeah.
I loved seeing the Wicked Witch of the West in it. She was brilliant in it. I loved her.
Yeah. I couldn't find a budget for that movie, but it wound up making like $3.2 million domestically in the United States. And I would figure it was probably $500,000 at its most expensive. Yeah. So,
you know what I would like to do is I'd like to merge sort of these films, where I want to take the concept of a murder house from the remake, but mm-hmm. make it look more like a house as in the original.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if they changed it entirely just so people wouldn't compare it to House on Haunted Hill. And if it was as simple as that.
You know, if you watch those two movies back to back, it really feels like this weird mixtape. Like,
yeah.
It really does.
They feel very similar as far as the way they're approached and the beats to it. Yeah, they're very similar movies in that regard. I mean, visually they look quite different, but there's a lot of just cool for cool's sake, a lot of designy stuff rather than things that make sense. I mean, you can start extrapolating stories, and this is a great thing that you could see there's a lot of great ideas that there's no real time for, so they just come off as cool ideas. That's the ghosts themselves for the most part. It's like, okay, well, they're all really unique, and you can extrapolate a backstory, and without those special features, you don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that's why I like the movie so much as far as the remake goes, is like, oh, there's so much I want to know more. And you're never gonna get it, but no matter how many times you watch it. But yeah.
I do think that the original 13 Ghosts has enough interesting ideas that you could adapt it as like a, you know, a limited series, like we were talking about, 13 episodes.
Yeah,
episode per ghost.
Yeah, they smoothed it out and just took their time, and you could have a present-day scenario with the house and the traditional story that William Castle had kind of laid out, and you can tell the backstories as the ghosts throughout the series, and much in the way the Haunting of Hill House miniseries took that wonderful story and made it into a much longer miniseries, and masterfully so.
Yeah, and like you can do that sort of back and forth between past and present, like with the past guy collecting the ghosts and sort of who he was and what kind of, he might have had an idea behind it. He might have been like, I want to capture ghosts and I need to know more. Like, was he concerned about the afterlife? Like, there could have been a lot more going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of missed opportunity, and both are movies of their time, and maybe another remake will come around. but maybe not too soon, because the movie, the remake movie was budgeted at $42 million, only had a week opening weekend of $15 million, went on to gross domestically slightly under the budget, just under $42 million, but worldwide it wound up making about $68 million. So very soft, probably didn't wind up making any real money. I mean, you would have needed to make 80 just to, I think, break even on that film.
Yeah.
So, not well received. IMDb rates the original film a 6.1 out of 10. The remake is 5.6 out of 10. So, ratings are fairly close on IMDb, but let's see what the critics thought. The critic score for the original film is 36%. So, critics didn't really like it, but they were often fairly hard on William Castle films as a whole.
Especially at the time.
Yeah. Maybe I want to take a stab at the audience score.
62.
Okay. Well, it includes modern audience scores, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that it's probably like around a 75.
Woo. Well, in reality, it's around 41.
Oh. Dang it.
41%. So, you know, Rotten Tomatoes is not super kind to this movie, but let's see how the remake fares. Ooh, critics were far harsher than they were on William Castle at only 15%.
Makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, what do you think the audience score is?
Like 28.
Okay.
I'm going to put it higher because there's a naked woman in it. I'm going to go back to my 62.
Okay, well, it does rate higher than you might think. It's still not great, but it did beat out. Audiences liked it a little bit better than the original at 49%. So about 50% of people that saw this movie liked it.
Ah, so they're half and half. They're like, some did, some did.
Yep. I mean, and you know, I can see why critics tore that movie apart. I mean, I enjoy the movie, but I certainly recognize the flaws in it. There's a lot of things that don't make a lick of sense, but it's pretty to look at.
and
very entertaining.
Yeah. Lost opportunities all around on it.
Yeah, I still find it a very entertaining movie.
Those are the types of movies that Scary Movie and Scary Movie 2 especially were making fun of.
Yeah, I wish Sam was able to join us because I know his wife really liked the remake, and apparently it terrified her. So I rarely wanted to talk to somebody who's actually scared of this movie. I mean, we're horror alum over here, so.
I'll tell you what scared me about the movie is all of these randomly moving panels where I could be squished or sliced and diced at any time. The house is what scared me. The ghosts, no.
What about the crushing a canopy bed in the original film? We didn't even bring that up.
Oh yeah, that was great, actually.
And then there was Kalina, who actually gets crushed in the panels by Criticos. Again, maneuvers her into this tight spot. And she goes squishy.
Yeah, see, that's scary. That's terrifying. You hit the wrong spot and you're dead in that house.
Yeah.
That's not a safe place to be.
It's weird at the end of that 60s movie where the family, it feels like they're not going anywhere and they're sticking around and the ghosts are still there. I would take the canopy off of every canopy bed.
Yes.
Like, no. Especially after you saw it happen once in the movie. Why wouldn't you have, like, nope, not sleeping there?
Nope. Drugs are a hell of a drug.
Granted, it was the kid, I think, in that bed, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yes, it was. But so, then the ghost comes and puts the guy in there.
Yeah, so the ghost actually saves the kid because they kind of like the kid. But maybe the crushing canopy bed, maybe that's why Dad let him stay there after seeing. Wasn't he the dad who saw the bed do that? And it was still in the son's room. Why did you let your kid stay in there? Probably because he's a fucking sociopath. That's why.
He's like,
that could take care of one of my potential problems.
Ben took him into that room and put him on the bed. He was in another room.
Right.
He's like, hey, my son Mike grew up to be a serial killer, but if nature or ghosts...
Well, Ben was the lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe this kid was Saw. Like, he was like, I grew up in a murder house. I'm just going to do that now.
maybe that was his future. Get cancer and you don't appreciate life. Want to play a game.
I've been around the dead. I know it's shitty.
I kind of wish that this movie came out after Saw, because I feel like some of the sensibilities that Saw had could have really benefited this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some bits where it's definitely Saw.
Yeah, but like I think a little bit before Saw. I think this is early 2000s, right? Saw is 04?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was talking about the 60s movie with all the other stuff, yeah. too.
Well,
with the kid.
It'd be interesting to see what another iteration with the new aesthetics around this story would look like, because there's still that sense of fun and whimsy about the remake that the original one had, but to take it into a much darker territory, I would call the remake, and even the original in some extent, a black comedy.
Yes.
I think if you were to do a remake that was like a TV show, it would really be good to do it. Maybe like a better version of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, where you just have really, really cool, scary ghosts. But just in general, the story is like not necessarily as frightening, but the ghosts are like really the star of the show.
I'm going to say the movie version of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is scarier than 13 Ghosts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
even,
definitely.
Even for its strong PG-13, there is some stuff in that movie that genuinely creeped me out as an adult, so
yeah the ghosts in that movie are crazy.
Yeah,
I'd see this as like a weird you'd have some sort of curator where like the guy's like, oh, let me tell you about the ghosts I have, and that's how you'd start the episode. It's like a crypt keeper, but it's like the guy who was the doctor who captured them.
Because you could have somebody who's going around trying to find violent ghosts, who's just trying to, you know, take them out of the world. He doesn't know how to get rid of them, but if he knows where they are.
The way I would tell this story as a series is you're having Criticos, or the Cyrus, the uncle character, interacting with the family before the tragedy. While he's collecting his ghosts, that's the good opportunity to get into their backstories of the ghosts. And as you catch up, then that 13th episode is, or near the 13th episode, maybe in the final three, that's when Criticos puts in his final plan, and then the family comes in to take over the house. So,
interesting.
So then you can at least keep all your cast together and still have an anthology style, but you kind of sneak it into there cleverly. Kind of like Lost did, where they tell the backstories of the main characters in flashbacks.
Yeah. The flashbacks are actually, you know, as some people might roll their eyes, if used correctly, flashbacks are really, really good for character development.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Haunting of Hill House did it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
Like where you've gone into the past. And then they show you the now, and it totally works the best. So it's great.
Yeah, really great. It's certainly the best haunting thing I've seen in quite some time, and we actually did cover the film versions of that as well. So of The Haunting. So go check it out, The Haunting. We also did The House on Haunted Hill, and now we've got 13 Ghosts in there as well. They all kind of feel similar in that regard, but go check out all those episodes. They're fun, and you can also tell everybody to check out whatever they like on our show. With well over, we're getting close to 250 episodes here now, and easily. So make sure you tell your friends and family about the show, and you can do that on social media as well. Make sure you follow us on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion the Remake at gmail.com. And don't be afraid to send us your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments. We're taking a fan challenge. We're going to be doing a fan challenge next week, so we're certainly happy to get your fan mail. And if you got a suggestion for a film, we do have some criteria, of course. It has to be accessible, so tell us where to find it. And, I mean, get a feel for the kind of weird things we like. So, you know, take a look at our back catalog. Make sure it's something we think might be viable. If we like your idea, we'll do it. And we've done quite a few lately. So keep the suggestions coming for the fantasy remakes, because they're a lot of fun for us. And check us out on our Libsyn page, and you can find all our past episodes there and all of the podcast providers. You can even find us on our new Wix site, where I would normally have Sam tell the address because I can never remember it. But you can find the links on our social media for those as well. So just go check it out there. Don't forget to check out my new web store for words and pictures if you're into comics. Check it out at WANDP, so it's WANDP.ca, and we will ship out to anywhere in Canada and the U.S. Go check out Jeff Alpha, our original host, and his VideoGameTrader.ca. And he's doing all of his stuff online there as well during these weird trying times. So help support local businesses. And go check out Dickens YYC on Twitch. It's a favorite of mine, a pub I can't go to right now that does a lot of industrial music. And as we speak, they're doing an online version of their Terminus Festival. It'll be over by the time you hear this episode, but those broadcasts will still be available on their Twitch channel, and you can make donations through there as well to help support live music and the bands that are involved in the Terminus events. And you can also catch them, I think, every Friday doing Hang the DJ events as well if you miss going out into the dance club. You do it in your own living room, and your neighbors might look at you weird if you don't shut the blinds, but that's okay. We're all doing weird stuff to get through right now and get entertained. That's right. They can do it too. They're only jealous because they don't know what you're listening to.
Or you could just, if they look at you really weirdly, just put a piece of paper written down what you're listening to, and maybe they'll join you.
There you go.
or you just write down, you know, tune into insert radio station here, and somebody tunes in, but it's not what you're listening to.
No, of course not. That'd be a fun game. That'd be a fun game. It's like elevator music.
Yeah,
it's really thrashing hard. That guy really likes elevator music. Okay, well, that was 13 Ghosts. I've been Jason.
Should I continue to be Trish, or should we have Jeff in the middle?
Well, I mean, I will be Jeff regardless of what happens.
Wait, Sam just threw off the whole dynamic there, didn't he?
Yeah, what's going to happen now? I don't know.
We were waiting on Sam to say, I'm always Sam.
He's still Sam, just away right now. Yeah. He's always Sam. In another's place.
Okay. And
he is,
you...
he is sans Sam.
Yes. Sans Sam. And you continue to be what?
I continue to be Trish.
And Jeff?
Well, I always come back and apparently stick around as Jeff Omega.
I can't believe I had to coax you through this. Like, we've only done this a million times.
Quite a few.
All right, I could retake it, but I'm not going to. We are out of here.
Just a moment before you leave. If any of you are not yet convinced there really are ghosts, take the supernatural viewer home with you. And tonight, when you're alone and your room is in darkness, look through the red part of the viewer, if you dare.